Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time, we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we talk about Brock's three-minute thesis winner, Leslie Nash, who advanced to the first-ever Canadian competition. We rediscover a long-extinct species of plankton, and we talk about an innovative new program designed to bring gymnastics to kids suffering from cerebral palsy. Bringing enlightened conversations to your day, Inquisitive Minds is on the air. Last month on Inquisitive Minds, we talked with Leslie Nash, the top qualifier in the Brock Finals for the three-minute thesis competitions held at universities across the country. Leslie wowed the local judges with her presentation entitled Simplicity, Investigating Tea as a Dietary Strategy for Better Bone Health. She did it again at the provincial finals in late April at McMaster University in Hamilton, where she and 18 other graduate student presenters gave it their best shot to move on to the next level. Leslie placed second in the top five, I'm happy to report, and now waits to hear if her video presentation earns top marks at the first ever national competition to be held later on this month. The national competition is sponsored by the Canadian Association for Graduate Studies and will be held as a virtual contest involving the 11 finalists from three regional competitions: Western Canada, Eastern Canada, and of course, Ontario. Leslie is busy this summer with lots of writing at Brock, which we talked about this past weekend when she stopped by our CFBU-FM studios to talk about that and her big win at 3MT.
That comes with a grad student life, but it's nice to get out of the lab and talk to people.
Well, before we get into the three-minute thesis that we wanted to talk about today, as a graduate student, here we are, we're in May.
Mm-hmm.
How busy is your schedule right now?
This year is a little different from last year, so I'm now in my second year of my master's. I just finished doing a lot of my experiments, so now I'm writing. And it's funny because I thought going into it, it wasn't going to be much work, but it seems like I'm just consistently editing, changing things, sending it back and forth between my supervisor. So it feels like it's crunch time.
So although Brock University, for all intents and purposes, is done for the semester,
mm-hmm.
your work continues.
Oh, definitely. All throughout the summer. It's nonstop.
Are you going to go right through the summer then?
Yeah, I will.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And here we are recording this in a nice little studio on a beautiful spring day, lamenting the fact that we're not out there enjoying it. And you're going to be doing that all summer.
Yeah, and I'm in the new Karen's building with the big window, so I get to watch everyone else be outside while I'm inside.
Ah, yes, that wonderful building, mm-hmm. which, as I discovered in April, was a bit of lightning rod for a little bit of discontent for people in the university. Let's talk first and foremost here about the three-minute thesis, because the last time you were on the program was just prior to April 24th. And you had won the Brock competition, and on the 24th of April, you were in Hamilton at McMaster.
Yep.
And I had every confidence that you would do well, and I think everyone who knows you probably felt, Leslie's going to be fine, we don't have to worry at all. But how well did you do? Because, I mean, the result is phenomenal.
Yeah, I came in second place out of all the contestants, so I ranked in the top five, which was really good.
So they only take the top five.
Mm-hmm.
So are all five of those going to the Canadian final?
Yes, we had provincial competition at McMaster for Central Canada. And there's going to be another competition that took place in Western Canada and another in Eastern. Five go from Central, three from Eastern, and three from Western to Nationals.
Okay. Yep. So you're basically number two.
Yes.
How did you feel coming in at number two? Like, were you at all surprised after you went through the competition and you heard everyone and you knew in your heart how you did? Did you think to yourself, I was surprised by that, or I'm pleased by that, or yeah, that's about where I should have been?
It was a little bit of both, of being surprised and obviously pleased with myself. going to provincials, it was obviously a step up from Brock University. Everyone did so well, and I found that there was such a vast range of topics, so anything from history, there is science, and then different areas of science. So it was a very intense competition because everyone did really well. Everyone knew their topic and could speak well to it and translated that knowledge to the general public really well. And it made it that much more terrifying when I was sitting there watching everybody else.
But you did both competitions at Brock, so you were familiar with the tension and the pressure that you would be under. How much greater was it being on that larger stage then?
I think the most terrifying part was when we went in, the stage is completely different from at Brock. So Brock, we had a TV that was beside us, and that was with us in the preliminary round at Brock University as well. So I had a good idea of what to expect. But when we went to McMaster, the room had more people. It was completely packed to the back of the doors where people were standing. And we had a big stage with multiple cameras on us. There's photographers everywhere. And then you had the two screens, one to the left and one to the right, that were huge. So it wasn't something that I could go up and interact with, which is what I'm used to and which is what I planned for. So when I went up and I'm trying to think about how am I going to interact with my slide to show people what I want to show without falling off the stage because they weren't connected to the stage, it was interesting to try and think on my feet as I was speaking.
Yeah, because your graphic that you're allowed to have, you are used to using that to your advantage to illustrate your point.
Yes.
But for people at the very back of a very large room, they're not going to be able to see it unless they're looking, I guess, at a screen.
Yeah.
So that changes the whole dynamic for you.
Especially because I wanted to be able to point to certain things on the graph to show them the decline in bone mineral density or show that the structures are similar. But I couldn't do that because they were just too high up and too big. So I tried to use the best of the stage as I could. And in addition to that, we had seven judges and they were spread across the stage. So usually I like to interact with both the audience and the judges, and it's usually easier because the judges are in one spot. But when they're spread across and the stage was huge, I had to walk across from left to right to make sure it felt like I was interacting with everybody.
It's good that you did that though, because if you're very static and you're just standing there, as good as your content may be, the presentation isn't what it should be. So to be able to move around on stage and be animated to some extent definitely helps your cause.
I felt like it did. It's good for me because I get really nervous when I go on stage. So to be able to move around is a nice way to release some of the tension that I feel when I go up on stage. So it's nice because the audience feels like I'm interacting with them and I just feel like I'm letting go of some tension and it works well.
Yeah. So I remember asking you after the preliminaries at Brock, if you were listening to each one of them and gauging how they were doing compared to what you and your heart knew you had. Were you able to do that again, and what were your feelings?
I started paying attention to the first one. So I was eighth in the list out of, I think, 19 or 20. And the first one was so well put together and so well expressed that I had to stop listening because it actually began to freak me out a little more. So I was sitting in my seat, and every time somebody would go up, I would just look down, think about my speech in my head or think about other things just to make sure that I wasn't getting sidetracked with how well everyone else was doing.
Yeah.
And then once I went up on stage, I sat back down. I was still nervous for a little while, so I tried not to pay attention because even after you spoke, you've done your piece, when you're watching everyone else and they do really, really well, it just becomes very real how good the competition is and how hard it is going to be to place.
Did you have any interaction with the judges? Was there any way to converse with the judges, or was it like it was at Brock where the judges, and I was one for the preliminaries, just scored you and that was it?
Yeah, so that was the same thing. We were brought into the room. We had a specific area we were asked to sit as the contestants, and then the judges were brought in after. They did a little piece on each of the seven judges, and that's the only time we got to interact with them, was on stage essentially.
What was the makeup of the judges? Were they any different from what you had experienced at Brock in terms of, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but in terms of social standing? Like, I mean, were these all academics, or were they just people from a wide variety of areas of expertise?
There were a wide variety of areas. There were academics, so we did have some individuals who did have a background in science, but we also had individuals who were working for a lot of news stations, so CBC, other types of journalists, somebody who worked for The Star. So different types of backgrounds, which was really nice, and I think we even had someone from Hamilton's football team there. So it was nice variety, especially considering the variety that we had for the different talks.
So the variety of the talks ranged from what you can remember. You, of course, did the effects of tea and the effects on osteoporosis and bone density.
Yep.
One of my favorite topics. But what were some of the other ones?
So there were actually a couple history talks, which is funny because I don't consider myself a big person on history. That's the one class when I was in high school that I could sleep through and everything would be okay. But the individuals were so well spoken. One did women's rights and CUPE and the history of women's rights. Another individual did Diefenbaker and how the Russians wrote about him. So he even taught himself how to read and write in Russian so that he could translate things himself. And those talks were spectacular. We had individuals in science who did talks on wastewater treatment. And there was one on dietary genetic analysis, so how we can individualize somebody's diet plan based on their genetics, which is the individual who actually won first place. It was just a wide variety. It was really good.
So you got a wide variety of knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
Listening to all these 3-minute theses over the course of that day. So you're number 2 in the top 5.
Yes.
So the next competition is when and where?
So there is a national competition. As far as the site is concerned, it's supposed to be in Montreal, but it's a competition that doesn't really take place with us being involved. So as far as I know, they videotaped us when we were all at provincials, same thing with Eastern and Western, and then the top videos are sent to nationals, and then they have judges rank us based on the videos that were sent in. So we don't actually have to do anything, which is a little odd to me for being a competition.
Yeah.
So we just wait for an email, I guess.
So in other words, you've essentially competed in the Canadian final.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So did you know that going in? Because if you know that going in, you're thinking, I've got to be really good today because not only do I have to win this competition, I'm already doing the Canadian competition at the same time.
No, I think that was the most disappointing thing. We had an idea that it may be a video competition, but the general consensus was is that it was going to take place after. So someone was going to come to the university or we were going to tape it ourselves of me presenting and then we would forward that to nationals. I had no idea that it was going to actually take place there until I believe either at the end of the competition or very beginning when we're already sitting down that they indicated to us that it was going to be taped there. So that was kind of terrifying and at the same time a little disappointing, I think.
When do you find out? Do you have any idea when the results will be announced?
They're supposed to be posted, I believe, in June 12th. I don't know if we're going to get emails before that or if they're just going to post it online.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed in the meantime.
Thank you.
Now, after April 24th, you got on a plane and you went to San Diego.
Yes.
So let's just talk briefly as we wrap up about that. What were you doing in San Diego and what was the purpose of the trip?
So I was going to experimental biology. It's a large conference that takes place every single year in the States. It's actually an international conference for science. So a lot of societies like the American Society for Nutrition or Physiology, Biochemistry all attend. So there's supposed to be tens of thousands of individuals who show up, do presentations. I did a talk as well as a poster presentation. Yeah.
Now, how long were you there?
Just about a week. So it was nice because I was able to go to the conference, learn more about my work I want to do on top of getting to do a little bit of the tourism stuff. We went to the zoo and experienced some of the food, went to Tijuana.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So you at least were able to mix a little bit of pleasure with your business.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And then you came back and you were thrown right back into the situation of Brock with all the work you've got to do.
Yeah, I was actually involved in Scientifically Yours the moment I got back. We had an overnight flight from 10 p.m. and we got back about 8 a.m. in the morning and I went right from the airport to Brock University to do a science camp for grade 11 girls. Yeah.
Oh man, how long was that for?
2 days, so it was a tiring week and a half.
Oh man. By the end of that, you must have just had one day where you just said, you know, world, I'll catch up to you later on.
Yeah, that's essentially how I spent my weekend, was just sleeping.
Oh wow. Well, no wonder you didn't answer my emails that weekend. Yeah, I can understand that. Leslie, congratulations. congratulations on the provincial competition being number two, which I think is amazing. And congratulations in advance to however the Canadian final ends up and whatever your ranking is. I know you've done us proud at Brock, and I thank you very much for that, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
That was Leslie Nash, a master's student in applied health sciences at Brock, who finished second at the provincial three-minute thesis competition held last month at McMaster. The first ever national virtual competition will be held later on this month, and we wish Leslie all the best. There is indeed life after death, at least according to a Brock University geologist and a team of international researchers who have discovered a living plankton that scientists had thought was extinct for the past million years. Professor Martin Head says, "This is the last remaining species of a plankton lineage that was very common about 50 million years ago. So what can we learn from this, and what can we do with the results of this research?" I invited Professor Head into the CFBU-FM studios recently to talk about the research, and I asked him, first of all, just what plankton is in the first place.
Well, plankton really is, these are the creatures that are floating around on or near the surface of the oceans, and they drift typically with the ocean currents, and they are very, very important for sustaining the food web within the oceans. Expand on this a little bit. There are certain kinds of plankton that are single-celled, and they are photosynthetic, which means they fix carbon from the atmosphere, and they give the oceans the biomass needed to food other members of the food chain. So some of these plankton are at the starting point of the food chain within the ocean. So they're extremely important.
Yeah, they would be part of the food chain. And it's a living organism, in other words.
That's right. Yeah. And some of these so-called primary producers, these are the organisms that basically harvest sunlight and then they turn it into biomass. Hmm. These organisms are single-celled organisms, and they are called phytoplankton. And they are the starting point in the food chain of many organisms. And of these phytoplankton that are found in the world's oceans, among the most important are the dinoflagellates. The dinoflagellates, the diatoms, the coccolithophores, these are very, very important primary producers, and they are phytoplankton.
So being part of the food chain, I would imagine they'd be very low down on the chain.
They're really at the bottom of the food chain. They're at the bottom because they are harvesting sunlight, and they are taking inorganic carbon, and they are turning it into organic molecules. This is photosynthesis. And by doing so, they are producing biomass that then the other organisms, small crustaceans, for example, will then feed on. And those small crustaceans are then fed on by larger organisms and ultimately by fish and maybe even marine mammals.
So essentially, if there were no plankton, we'd have a big problem.
If there were no plankton, we would be in deep trouble. Deep trouble. The oceans would die.
So how many species of plankton are there?
Well, I can't speak for all of the groups of plankton. I'm a specialist of dinoflagellates, and there are several thousand dinoflagellate species in the oceans today. But the interesting thing, you see, I'm a biologist. I'm a geologist. I'm not really a biologist. But I am one of these geologists who works at the interface of another discipline. And I work at the interface of geology and biology. So I'm very interested in these living dinoflagellates because they produce a geological record. And that's really the fascinating thing about these particular dinoflagellates, is that they have a cyst stage within their life cycle. Mm-hmm. And these dinoflagellates, remember, they are protists. They are single-celled organisms, maybe only around 50 or 60 microns in size, so they are typically not visible to the naked eye. They have to be examined under a microscope. Now, within their life cycle, during the winter or late summer, the cells round up. They produce an organic layer that's very resistant, often with spines and other ornamentation, and then they sink to the bottom. And then they overwinter in these so-called cysts. And then in the spring, the cyst hatches out, a swimming cyst then makes its way to the surface and the process starts all over again. Now, from my perspective as a geologist, the interesting thing is that the cyst wall that has been left behind in the sediment becomes geologically preservable. And so we can actually track the geological evolution of these species of dinoflagellate way back through the geological record. Hmm. And so that's where I come into this story.
Okay, so the cyst would essentially be, to draw an analogy here, I would imagine it would be like an eggshell.
Something like an eggshell, yeah. Yes. Okay. To draw a loose analogy, something like an eggshell. But we think of eggs as being smooth-walled.
Yeah.
And these particular eggs have got spines and crests and all kinds of ornamentation over them. Now, that's very important because this ornamentation on each species of cyst allows us to tie the cyst morphology or its shape with the living dinoflagellate species that the biologists have identified from the swimming cell.
So the cyst, the shape of the cyst or the ornamentation, if you will, on the cyst would denote perhaps a different species.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Every species has its own kind of cyst.
Okay.
So therefore, one can track that species down through the geological record. Now, this is important because the swimming stage of a dinoflagellate is not geologically preservable. The only part of the life cycle that is geologically preservable is the cyst itself, because it's made of this very resistant organic polymer that is intended essentially to keep out the bacteria during the winter while this thing is sitting out harsh conditions. But because it has such a resistant, biologically, chemically resistant wall, it means that the chemical processes that take place within the geological record that turn loose sediment into hard rock, those processes do not affect the cyst wall. So the cyst wall itself, although the insides will deteriorate over time, the cyst wall itself remains intact for millions and millions of years in the geological record.
So if we could take the makeup of the cyst wall, we could have a very durable product that we could use in another application if we could.
Yes, that's interesting. The problem with substances that are very durable is that in order to identify them and work out their makeup, we have to actually destroy the substance first. Mm-hmm. In order to see what it's made up of.
Exactly.
So very durable materials like these essentially bioplastic type materials are actually very difficult to examine because they are so durable and therefore you have to really half destroy them to figure out how they're made up.
So
this is work in progress.
But it's fascinating because it's so durable and yet it's so minute.
Absolutely,
and
yes.
And you're able to find these.
Well, yes, that's very interesting as well. The reason we're able to concentrate them in the marine sediments is because of their durability. So we'll take some mud, or indeed we can take a rock specimen from the bottom of the ocean. We then dissolve that rock or that sediment in a sequence of acids, and those acids will remove the mineral component of that rock or sediment. And what's then left is a kind of organic sludge. And from that sludge, which is now concentrated because we've removed the mineral component, that sludge now will contain dinoflagellate cysts. So we then take that sludge in the lab. We'll often use brief ultrasound to clean things up, and then we sieve that sludge at around 10 or 15 microns. Hmm. All of the very fine garbage goes through. And what we're left with then are these organic walled microfossils, if indeed they're from the rock record, then microfossils. And we then mount those on microscope slides and we look at them under the microscope. And that really then becomes the exciting job.
Yeah.
Because then you're scanning under the microscope and then suddenly you'll find an interesting dinoflagellate cyst that may be from recent sediments or it may be from rocks that are millions and millions of years old.
Yeah. This is a lot of work to go to discover these cysts. And the reason I'm asking this is because you had to have some inkling that there was something worthwhile in doing this much work to discover this. So what was the process that you arrived at where you determined this is where we want to do this, and this is the work we're going to do to determine what's in there. In other words, how did you know, if you indeed you did know, that the cysts would be there to begin with?
Well, the kinds of people who look at these cysts are people typically interested in dating rocks. The oil industry is very interested in the geological record of cysts. So there is quite a long literature, quite a an extensive literature going back over the past 50 years or more on the fossil distributions of these cysts. And one of the main boosts to the science of dinoflagellate research comes from the oil industry itself, because the oil industry realized that it could take these dinoflagellate cysts and use them to date rocks, and that's very important in the oil industry. You see different species evolve, live for a specific duration of time, and then become extinct. So by looking at a fossil spot, a rock, a fossil assemblage of dinoflagellates, and by determining what species are there and which ones are not, we can determine the age of that rock. That's valuable for the oil industry.
Sure.
Now, that's the geological aspect of dinoflagellate research. Now, dinoflagellates are also important to biologists and to ecologists, because dinoflagellates, or at least some species of dinoflagellates, produce toxin. And these dinoflagellates are ingested by shellfish. The shellfish then concentrate those toxins in their flesh. We as humans then harvest these shellfish, and we can become very sick, and we can even die from ingesting tainted shellfish. And that tainting, that poisoning of the shellfish, comes from dinoflagellates. Now, as I've already mentioned, these dinoflagellates come from cysts. So if you can determine where the cysts are, then you can predict where the next outbreak of toxic dinoflagellates will be. And this is very, very important to the fisheries industry and to the shellfish industry and to the tourist industry.
Sure.
So the biologists are also very interested in the cysts. So you've got the biologists interested in modern cysts. You've got geologists interested in fossil cysts. So we as people who are interested in dinoflagellates and their evolution generally, we have a lot of literature that helps us to understand some of the problems that we're trying to investigate. And we realize that it might be interesting to look at modern sediments from the central western Pacific, because there might be something interesting there that perhaps, I mean, scientists are always looking for a new discovery. We didn't know what we would find, but no one had really looked in any great detail at these modern surface sediments in the oceans before. So we thought, let's just see what's there. And we were very surprised to find a cyst species that was thought to have become extinct a million years ago.
And that must have been really exciting when you made
that
discovery.
Well, that was exciting. Yeah. I mean, I certainly can't take all the credit for this. The lead author on this particular study is a colleague of mine, Kenneth Mertens, from the University of Ghent in Belgium. And he was seconded to Nagasaki University actually about 3 years ago, so it's taken all that time for the results to have become properly digested and then published. So he went to Japan, where they have a very strong reputation for marine sciences, and they did their collecting, and they found some cysts, and they thought they were interesting, and that's when they got in touch with me and said, hey, Martin, what are these things? We think they may be something interesting. Can you tell us a bit more about them? And I have a lot of experience with the fossil record, and I immediately recognized what this was, and we were able then to work out a geological story along with the biological story.
Now, these were found in these cysts that caused the interest were found on the floor of a part of the Pacific Ocean.
In several parts.
Oh, several.
We collected from a number of I think from about six different locations in different parts of the so-called Indo-Pacific Warm Pool.
And they were in all of those sections?
They were in all of these samples.
So theoretically, if you discover other parts of the Pacific Ocean that you want to explore,
yes,
theoretically they could be there as well.
They could be there as well, and they could be there along with other species that perhaps we didn't know were still living.
Yeah.
That's one of the sort of exciting things about this research, is that it points us in the direction of the so-called Indo-Pacific Warm Pool, this part of the Pacific. Pacific that hasn't really changed much in temperature over the last glaciation. So it's a perfect refuge for warm water species that are looking for somewhere to sit out maybe 10 or 20,000 years of very cold conditions elsewhere in the world's oceans.
So that warm pool would have a more regulated temperature than other parts of the Pacific Ocean, then?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So during an interglacial, such as the present one, much of the world's tropical world's oceans are warm. But during glaciations, such as the last glaciation about 14,000 years ago, many parts of the world's oceans, even in the lower latitudes, became rather cooler. Obviously, the higher latitudes became very cold, but even the low latitudes around the equatorial belt, there was considerable cooling in certain parts of the world's oceans. But the Indo-Pacific warm pool, that's the western part of the Pacific Ocean around Indonesia and Micronesia and these islands in the central patch of the world's oceans, didn't cool very much. There was cooling, but not sufficient cooling to kill all of these warm water species. And so some of them did survive.
So what about climate change then? As other areas of oceans around the world warm up, at least that's what we assume is going to be the end result. Does that affect this situation here?
Well, it affects it in a positive way, in the sense, now I'm not advocating that we try to accelerate global warming.
No. No one is advocating that. Yeah.
But in the future, we would anticipate the geographical range of this species to expand, because it's a warm water species. So therefore, we know it's a warm water species not only because of where it's living today, but also because we know that from the past geological record, this particular species expanded its geographical range during warm intervals of the geological record. And so we can anticipate that with global warming, this species will again expand in its geographical distribution. So it could even be used, perhaps, as a barometer of global warming in the future.
Yeah, which would probably, some would argue, be one of the only good side effects of global warming.
Yes, one of very few. One of very few. But depending on where you are. But globally,
yeah,
Global warming's not a good thing. And we should have done something about it a long time ago.
Well, yeah. And that goes without saying. And that's,
yes,
a conversation for another day. But
yes, that's right.
This is interesting research that is shedding a different light on global warming and the effects of it.
It is indeed. There's one other interesting aspect to all of this, and of course this is the biological aspect, and of course everyone is interested in evolution and where it's going,
yeah,
and where it's been. In order to try to understand where evolution is going, we really need to understand more about the past effects of evolution. And there's a lot of interest in the evolution of the plankton. And because we now have this fossil, this essentially a living fossil that was thought to have gone extinct a million years ago, finding it living has meant that we've been able to work out the genome of this species, and that's been fascinating. Well, of course, we assumed that we would be able to run genetics on this species and then compare it with all of the known dinoflagellate species for which we have genetic information. And we thought we would get some sort of a match somewhere that would allow us then to say, ah, yes, well, this living species is closely related to some other species that we know to be living.
Hmm.
Well, we found no such match at all. There's nothing out there that is genetically anywhere similar to this particular species that we've found. And when you think about it, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
This is a species that went extinct a long time ago. We know from the geological record that this species is the last remaining species of a very important lineage of dinoflagellates that existed about 50 million years ago. And over geological time, all those species within that lineage all became extinct, with this one species remaining. So, of course, there are no close living relatives today.
Yeah.
They've all died out. So that was an interesting sort of side shoot of the research that we were doing.
Do we have any idea why it was thought to be extinct? In other words, for all a million years, It was assumed it was extinct.
Yes.
What caused that?
Well, it was assumed to have gone extinct because of severe glaciations that occurred about a million years ago.
And it was too cold for it?
And it was assumed, you see, when the research into the geological record of these species was done, most of that research was done in the Atlantic Ocean. And okay. That's partly because of the oil industry.
Yeah.
And that's the case because, now I'm going to introduce a little bit of technicalities here, but the Atlantic Ocean has continental shelves, unlike the Pacific Ocean. And these continental shelves have a geology that allows them to trap oil and gas. So there's been a lot of history of exploration for oil and gas in the Atlantic Ocean. So we know a lot about the geological ranges of these species of dinoflagellates. And within the Atlantic, this species goes extinct. No, extinct is perhaps not the right word. We now know that it's not extinct, but it was thought to have gone extinct a million years ago. And we assumed, we didn't have any evidence, but we assumed that that was because a million years ago, the world's climate started to get very cold. And so we just assumed that this warm water species had not made it through that severe glaciation that occurred about a million years ago.
Wow.
But really, in fact, it was in fact living still in the Pacific.
And it took all this time.
It took all this time
to
realize that.
That's amazing.
Yes.
And you're a part of it.
And I'm a part of it. And it's a great privilege to be part of research like this. It was serendipitous. We didn't know what we would find. This is the excitement of doing research. You never know what's around the corner. You never know what you might find.
The research, I mean, this is fascinating research, but where do we go with this? What can we do with this now?
Well, we, not necessarily me, but we, researchers, go back to the Indo-Pacific warm pool and start looking in more detail now for fossil, well, for more, so to speak, living fossils. And surely there will be more there. What we also need to do is start drilling cores in the Indo-Pacific warm pool to find out what the geological record of these living fossils is through the geological record in the Indo-Pacific warm pool. This opens up a whole load of new avenues of research, of course, which is very exciting. And I hope to be part of that, of course, and I hope to take on graduate students to help me address some of these very interesting issues that have now arisen.
So this is only a beginning. I mean, it's a great discovery, but this is only the beginning. It opens up huge new vistas for you for research.
I certainly hope so. It's a new beginning, and moving over to the Pacific, I think, is going to be very, very exciting. Very much looking forward to it.
Professor Head, this is really amazing news, and I thank you very much for coming in and sharing it with us.
Thank you, Mike. It's been a great pleasure.
That was Professor Martin Head, a Brock geologist who was part of a team of international researchers who have discovered a living plankton species scientists had thought was extinct for the past million years. A new initiative is being launched geared specifically for children living with cerebral palsy, and it promises to have an impact worldwide. The CanFlip program, developed by McMaster University student Olivia Cook and Brock Professor of Kinesiology Nota Klintru, introduces children with CP to gymnastics, something viewed up until now as not a safe option. But introducing children with CP to gymnastics can not only be safe, it can also be beneficial to their development, according to Cook and Klintru, who worked on the program the past 2 years and put together a research proposal and pilot program the Ontario Federation of Cerebral Palsy funded. Both Olivia Cook and Nota Klintru joined us on the program recently to discuss this program, CanFlip, and how it works. And I asked them first to describe what CP is.
Well, cerebral palsy is really an umbrella term for lesions normally in the developing fetal or infant brain that results in a disorder of the development of motor skills.
Is this something that you would be born with, or can a child acquire it?
A child can acquire it in very early age, so within the first few months of life, but most commonly it occurs during development when they're still a fetus.
Given the effects of CP, it would seem natural to assume gymnastics would be out of the question for these children, but I presume balance would be viewed as a barrier to taking part in gymnastics activities.
Yes, absolutely. This is the problem because now, as Olivia explained, it's an umbrella term. So there are different levels of CP. So there are kids who can actually walk, and there are other kids who are actually in a wheelchair. So the different mobility skills amongst children with CP, they're not all the same. However, regardless if the child can actually walk, still, balance is an issue, and in gymnastics, you know how balance is very important. There are also impaired motor skills, so in any case, even if it's not a balance skill, any skill would be a challenge for these kids. So safety was always the biggest concern, because it was always thought that children cannot safely perform the skills, or even if they do, they may require more than one spotter around them.
So how did you discover the opposite appears to be the case, gymnastics can actually help these children to develop?
Well, it was a hypothesis. We didn't necessarily expect that they will be able to carry on with the program, or what the results would be for their everyday skills. However, I will let Olivia explain how the idea, because it was her idea, and she started with other disabilities, and CP came later in the project. So, Olivia, you want to start with your high school idea?
Sure. So, in grade 10, a girl who had retinopathy of prematurity, so a visual impairment, was brought to our gymnastics club, and unfortunately she was turned away because we didn't have the proper program in place to provide her the safety that she would require and the extra assistance that she needed in the gym. So I volunteered to coach her one-on-one, and it was through that experience, and I coached her for about 3 years, that myself and the parents and the child began to notice huge improvements in their motor skills and in her cognitive development as well. And so it was through this that we really began to see the benefit of the sport. And then following working with this child, I began to open up the program to children with any disabilities. And we continually saw these same improvements, no matter the child's disability. And so that's really when I brought the idea to Noda, and she suggested that we work with children with cerebral palsy.
With that first child, when you talked to the parents of that child, mm-hmm. what was their reaction?
I think they were surprised at the amount that their child was able to accomplish in the gym. There's a lot of views and stereotypes about gymnastics, but those are commonly associated with high-level gymnastics. Working with kids who are in elementary school in the gym, you're really just using a safe space for the kids to practice everyday motor skills and develop muscle strength and develop coordination and balance. And so I think it's understanding that side of the sport, the recreational side, that I think people don't immediately understand. And so that was what the parents were really surprised about, was how well that child was able to do gymnastic skills that they really thought she'd never be able to do.
So specifically, what kind of motor skills would we be looking at seeing some kind of improvement in?
Well, with the kids in our study, at the first few practices, it would really be just walking on the balance beam, practicing balancing on numerous surfaces, different mats. But by the end of it, the children were doing cartwheels on the floor exercise. They were doing front rolls and back rolls on the balance beam, jumps by themselves on the trampoline, which is really hard for children to maintain their balance on. So skills that I would be doing with any other children, their same age level.
How gradual would the improvement be?
Well, the study ran for 6 weeks, and there were 2 practices each week, so 12 practices in total, and the development was fairly gradual. I'd say the first few weeks, the children were really becoming comfortable in the environment, comfortable with the different surfaces and the skills that they were being asked to do, and developing that confidence that they'd then be willing to try more advanced skills. But it was a fairly gradual process from about that second week to the sixth week.
The children themselves, you were just talking about what they're comfortable doing. What was their reaction when they realized, I've never been able to do this before? I can actually do this, and this is fun.
It was that exact reaction that I personally found the most rewarding and the parents found to be really exciting. I think that at the beginning of the program, the children were a bit hesitant, but very eager because they've never been able to do gymnastics before. And actually, a few of them, their siblings, did gymnastics. So often they would sit with their parents and watch their other sibling do gymnastics while they just kind of sat around. So it was great for them to finally say, no, it's my turn. And they were just shocked and overjoyed by learning different skills. And that's what the parents commented on, was they were so happy to see their child achieve a goal in such a short amount of time.
And they would build their confidence through that, which could lead to successes, I would think, in other areas other than gymnastics, I think.
Absolutely.
That is probably the most important of the achievements of the program. Because often we are, like myself, I'm a physiologist, so we're always looking into physiological and motor improvements. But maybe the most important achievement here is that these children felt like they can do things, they can achieve things, they gained their confidence, and they were very happy. I remember the first little girl who came for the testing, and I saw her for the first time, and I introduced Olivia to her like her coach. So this is your coach. And I could see in her eyes the happiness of, oh my God, I have a coach. I am an athlete. And it was a fantastic experience for me also to, you know, to see way beyond the physiological measurements and what we really physiologically improve, because the improvement may be very small, but the psychological aspect may be a lot more important. So we should not forget that these children were able to perform new skills for the first time in their lives and be actually in an environment with other kids of their age, because the classes ran during regular hours when other gymnasts were in the gym. So they were not segregated. They were integrated into the gymnastics program. So that was also something that I think had a lot of impact in their lives.
I was going to ask about that, because obviously they have special needs that have to be addressed, but you don't want to appear to be singling them out so that they appear different from others who, as you say, would be in the same gymnasium doing activities as well.
Yes, of course. And that happens in the schools too. That's what they talk a lot about, inclusion lately. So the children arrive in the gym or the class, and there are other kids around them who are different, and they have their own coach, personal trainer, whatever, but they're not segregated. They're not hidden, you know, behind a different wall or in a different time. So they're part of the environment. Of course, they have their own program, but that is not unusual for gymnastics, because there are so many different levels in a gymnastics program. So the coach is not unusual to take aside an athlete and do something different. So that helps integrate them without feeling that they cannot, of course, do exactly the same thing as the other gymnast, but they can do well what they can practice. And practice makes it better, and that's the most important aspect here, that the body will adapt as it practices. So it needs a regular repetition of the same skills and corrections and attention to detail, and everybody can actually achieve skills and perform gymnastic skills.
And through that success, their self-esteem will grow as well.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. And as you see yourself be able to do more, I mean, that happens with everybody. You see yourself do better and better every day, so now you dare do a little more. And that's the idea behind sports and exercise and child development, because that is the safest way in front of someone who is an expert and has the ability to provide safe practice to the kids to repeat and enjoy and achieve and then go to the next level and repeat and so on and so forth. So that's the idea why an organized sport may be a good way to train children with different disabilities in a safe environment.
So let's talk about the CanFlip program. When is the program going to be fully implemented?
We don't know that yet, because myself, I am part of the International Gymnastics Federation. I already talked to them, presented the program, and I'm ready now to send the full paper with the results and the video, because we prepared the video for them, and then try to train the trainers, because that would be the next step. You cannot really grow a program based on Olivia Cook, right? You need more like her to be able to manage this level of coaching, which is completely different. First of all, it's personal. It's like a personal coaching. And also, it needs a little more personal involvement. So we need to train the trainers and feel comfortable to actually coach these kids. And we go from there. It will take time, because as Olivia explained, there are stereotypes out there. But I think by having the first results, it's promising. First of all, we know it can happen. It's feasible, because we did it. We know Olivia was there in the gym with them, and she can be now the ambassador, taking the program a step further.
So let's talk about the testing that you're doing with these children. How are you actually going about it? Getting into the, sort of like the nuts and bolts of how you're dealing with the children who are in the program.
So we tested the children 3 times, once prior to the gymnastics classes, one following the gymnastics classes, and then another follow-up. And at each of those sessions, they underwent standardized testing that examined everything from their willingness to participate in physical activity, their gait, their motor coordination, their muscle strength, and their range of motion. And it was through those standardized testing that was conducted at Brock University that we were able to actually measure the change. But each child underwent that 3 times.
Were the results from that very first child that you dealt with that got the ball rolling on this, any difference in the results there and what you've seen with the children that through this program you've been able to work with? In other words, do the results vary?
Well, I suppose we tailored our testing towards children with cerebral palsy, so things that we would expect to see change. So kids with CP often have spasticity, so reduced range of motion, commonly in their ankles and their hips. So that was something we were really particular in looking at through our gait analysis and through a range of motion. Whereas with that first child who had a visual impairment, that would have been more looking at her balance, her ability to stay focused in a space and get comfortable in her spatial orientation. So that would have been more of a change that we'd see with her as opposed to these children who had cerebral palsy.
So you're able to tailor the program to the needs of each individual child.
Absolutely.
It's not a one-size-fits-all.
Absolutely. And that was the challenge in developing the CanFlip program. Even though we had 5 kids, all of whom had cerebral palsy, like Noda mentioned, there's varying levels of cerebral palsy. So although these children were all classified as level 1 or 2, meaning that they were all independently mobile, the abilities and the limitations for each child were drastically different. And so each class with every child had to be tailored and personalized to fit their individual needs.
The program is in the early stages. So how far do we go with this? How far do you plan to go with the testing and with discovering how successful we can be here?
We have a new collaborator in the team who is from UK, and he's an expert in neuromuscular activation measurement, which is the most important, I think, of the testing when we deal with something like cerebral palsy. And we plan to make a few changes into the program. We talked about what about group activities, what about having more than one child in a group, which also works more onto their social skills. We do need to see more invasive, as I said, testing. Not invasive that is uncomfortable for the kids. This is all surface and gross motor testing, so nothing more invasive than that. But it is more invasive in the analysis of the signals and so on. So we do have plans for the next step. We will therefore carry out another phase of CanFlip. The first one was done in the gymnastics energy club and in Burlington Gymnastics, who were fantastic. Both clubs were fantastic to actually welcome and accommodate the needs of the program, and we are very thankful for that. And they are very, very excited themselves to be able to do that for these kids. And I hope that we will partner again. The first phase was funded by the Ontario Federation of Cerebral Palsy, and I hope to continue that also, that partnership also, because we need a lot of personnel to carry out this this type of testing and this type of program. So we do have plans for the next 2 years to repeat CanSLIP, probably with more kids and a little different testing, and see if we can investigate more mechanistically what happens and we see this improvement. And is it only psychological and social, or is it true physiological improvements?
Can either one of you see the day in the perhaps not too distant future where programs like this CanSLIP is the norm rather than the exception?
Absolutely. I think that more and more we're seeing how physical activity can really be the best form of preventative medicine. And that's what we're unfortunately seeing, is that as people with motor disabilities age, their participation in physical activity reduces. And along with that, we're seeing a reduction in their physical ability. And so by making programs like this available, we're really hoping that this might be a way that people can continue, not just children, but adults with motor disabilities, continue to participate in physical activity so that we don't see that decline in physical function, which I really hope that that could be the future, not only just within gymnastics, but in other sports.
Noda, for you?
Yes, absolutely. I think this is the future. If we want to make kids more physically active, we have to be able to provide fun, sporty activities that where they feel comfortable, but they also feel challenged. And I don't believe there is nothing wrong with any of these children or other children. All children have their, you know, unique skills and unique abilities, and that's all it is. And we should not segregate or treat anybody any different. We have to integrate and include and be and cater every program to the needs of each individual child. And I think that's the future. My dream would even be to include artistic gymnastics in Special Olympics, because I see no reason why other sports are part of the Special Olympics and not artistic gymnastics. And maybe because it's in younger ages, this is a youth sport, we can start early, build the love for activity to these kids and make them happy and accomplished.
Now, Noda, you've got your career. You're well established. But Olivia is a little bit younger. Your career is ahead of you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious, now that you've had this success and what you've discovered with CanSLIP, what's in the future for you? What do you see in the future for Olivia?
Well, I'm hopefully going to be attending medical school this upcoming school year. But along with practicing medicine, I want to continue my involvement in research in applied health sciences. And the team at Brock University has been so supportive to me over the past 2 years in running the CanSLIP program and getting it off its feet. So I'd love to be able to continue my involvement with their team and with Noda, as it really has been such a wonderful learning opportunity for me.
Noda and Olivia, thank you both very much for your time. This is great news, and I think a lot of people are going to be very pleased with what you've been able to accomplish and what you'll be accomplishing in the future with CanSLIP. And we wish you both all the luck in the world with developing the program.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mike.
And there we heard from Olivia Cook, a McMaster University student, and Brock Professor of Kinesiology and Associate Dean of Applied Health Sciences, Nota Clintrue, talking about the innovative new CanSLIP program they developed to introduce children with cerebral palsy to gymnastics. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPUFM.